Thanks for coming. So instead of a title slide, my first slide is going to be this great quote by the late organic geochemist John Hedges. He loved language and was a great writer. And I love this quote. He says, "Organic matter is a thermodynamic anomaly atop a free energy precipice." And he thought a lot about marine sediments, but he was a strong advocate of people who study marine sediments and people who study soils working together to try to understand how it is that organic matter gets pushed off this free energy precipice. So here's my title slide. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about that, about what happens when the enzymes that microbes make decay or induce the decay of soil organic matter substrates. And then what happens after the microbes take up some of those released substrates. And we're going to specifically be thinking about how microbial carbon use efficiency and C13 discrimination can change as temperature and substrate C to N change. So why are we interested in these things? So microbial carbon use efficiency is a measurement that we can use that tells us something about the propensity of a microbial cell or population or community to generate its own biomass versus other potential fates of that carbon, right? And one of the key fates that we're interested in is CO2. And we're interested in C13 discrimination because as soil biogeochemists, a lot of us run around the world measuring the delta C13 of respired CO2, and we try to infer from that what is happening in our soils, right? And we're interested in temperature because of concerns about climate change, but I would argue that we're also interested in it because we really don't know the answer to a very fundamental question. How does carbon flow through soils change with temperature? We don't know that the answer to that deceptively simple-sounding question. And the substrate C to N is important because for lots of reasons, but one of them is that if you look at this photograph on the right, which comes from Dan Richter's archives of Calhoun CZO photos, that we can see that dramatic landscape scale changes occur as a result of human land use. And when erosion occurs, we see changes in the composition and thus the stoichiometry of material that becomes closer to the surface and has a greater propensity to decay. So we're going to explore some of these issues today. So a lot of what we need to think about to do a good job with this comes into the realm of microbiology, which I am not a microbiologist. But we can be good soil biogeochemists and think pretty critically about what happens within a soil profile and what the measurements that we often make might mean. So as unsuspecting biogeochemists, we often go to the field and we measure CO2 efflux off soil surfaces and often the isotopic composition of that material. But our challenge comes about because there are myriad substrates within the soil profile that could be used to generate that CO2, right? The CO2 is this net integrator of what's going on within the soil. And further complicating our efforts to understand this, there's this tremendous diversity of microbes. So this is just one example of lots of papers that are coming out describing the tremendous diversity of microbial communities within soils. And within those communities, we don't know who's active. We don't know even who's alive. And so we have this conundrum. And when we go to soil profiles like this one from the Calhoun CZO, our problem becomes even greater when we consider that as you move down through the soil profile, we have these compositional changes. And in addition, so I'm focusing here on the stoichiometry, but there are a lot of compositional changes in the soil organic matter substrates that are available to microbes. And in addition to that, on the right-hand side of the down arrow there, you can see that there are very different temperature regimes, right? So we don't just have this general warming trend to think about, but we have very basic questions about, like, what happens when you have greater temperature fluctuations closer to the surface compared to down deeper in the soil profile on a daily and an annual timescale. And in addition to this, we have this general warming. So our problem gets even more complex when we think about the tools that we have at hand. So if we're interested in carbon use efficiency of a microbial population or community, to really quantify that, we need to understand the specific growth rate, which Stuart's talk nicely was getting at. We need to get to the specific growth rate, and we also need to know the mass-specific uptake rate for any unit of time, right? And these are very difficult things to quantify in a soil that's unperturbed. Whoops. So one of the things that we do is we can assume that if microbes don't exude a lot of organic carbon, which sometimes is true, but often is not, we can substitute for the denominator there the specific respiration rate plus the specific growth rate and consider those to be the two possible fates of carbon that's taken up by a community in a soil. But these things are very difficult to quantify in real soils, right? If we don't know who's active, it's obviously very difficult for us to quantify how quickly they're growing in an unperturbed system. So to try to get at this, we devised a system in our lab, a chemostat system. So I kind of did this with my teeth gritted because I really enjoy working with soils, but I was frustrated with us not being able to know if our inferences about soil respiration and changing rates of respiration, and in addition to that, the isotopic composition of that respiration, whether our inferences were true. So we devised this system where the reactor on the right there can be manipulated so that we know precisely the growth rate of the microbial populations and communities in there, and we can offer them a known substrate with a known isotopic composition so that we, when we change the temperature or otherwise change the environment in this reactor, we know that the substrate that the microbes are choosing to use is not changing. So we hooked this up to a continuous analyzer so that we can get real-time measurements of microbial respiration and the isotopic composition of what they're respiring. So first, I'll show you results from our experiments where we just varied temperature, and then later I'll very briefly show you what happens when the substrate C to N is changing. So remember that we're interested in trying to understand how temperature influences microbial flow of carbon, so flow into and out of these cells, and in addition, how the substrate C to N changes, just to try to get a fundamental picture of what might be going on in soil profiles with much more complex communities and much more complex substrate mixes. So the first thing that we did was just vary the temperature and try to maintain as constant a growth rate as we possibly could. And what we showed was that for a constant growth rate, we see this increase in specific respiration rate. So I've made these lines green because later when I add more data, you'll be able to pick out these original data. So the specific respiration rate, this increase in specific respiration rate with a constant growth rate allowed us to compute the carbon use efficiency of these microbes. So this decline in carbon use efficiency with increase in temperature has been inferred by lots of soil studies. And these data substantiate those inferences, right? They tell us that when we get closer to actually empirically observing what the carbon use efficiency is, we do see this evidence that those inferences from real soil studies is true. But when we look at the isotope story, we get what I think is an interesting result that gives me pause and makes me question a lot of the isotope data that we collect. So we offered cellobios as a substrate, as one example, and we know that its constant delta C13 value was about minus 24. And when we changed the temperature, we saw a strong variation in biomass delta C13 that was not monotonic. So there was a lot of variation here, it was about 7.5 per mil, but it was not predictable by temperature. And we saw a corresponding variation in the isotopic composition of the CO2 that they respired. Again, not predictable, but strong variation. And keep in mind that this isotopic composition of respired CO2 is what we often measure. And we infer things like, well, maybe as the temperature changes, the substrate that the microbes are using perhaps changed. But here we kept that substrate constant. This is proof of concept that isotopic signature can change just as a function of temperature. So we're not sure what this means, but we think that these abrupt changes might reflect changes in the metabolism of these microbes. And if you look at recent literature coming out looking at evidence for isotopic discrimination during root respiration, we see some nice papers coming out that are demonstrating that these different steps in heterotrophic respiration, so these are in roots, right? So it's autotrophic organisms, but heterotrophic respiration in roots follows the same pathways as heterotrophic respiration generating CO2 in microbes. And there are different fractionation factors at each step along the way. And so our data are consistent with shifts in the relative dominance of these different respiratory pathways and the decarboxylation steps. So when we look at the biomass and CO2 isotope values, we can calculate the respiratory isotope discrimination, and that is what we found actually had a predictable relationship with temperature. And in turn, we think that that can be quite important when we are going to ecosystems and trying to understand what's driving the isotopic composition of the CO2 that we're seeing. It looks like it is the discrimination between the active biomass generating that CO2 during the respiratory step. Now, when we go out to the field and we think about what's really happening as we move down through the soil profile where there are different temperature regimes and different stoichiometries of substrates, now we can look at some data where we varied that substrate stoichiometry. So I'm going to show you a series of plots where the green dots are the data that you've already seen, and the blue and the red are lowering and increasing the carbon to nitrogen of the resources that the microbes had available to them. And we lowered and increased those C to N values such that they were below and above the microbes themselves to see what we would find. And what we found was pretty counterintuitive, at least to me. We predicted that the specific respiration rate, the middle plot, would go up with temperature, but that effect would be most dramatic when the C to N ratio of what was available to the microbes would be highest. And instead, we saw the opposite. We saw this strong effect that when the C to N was actually below that of the microbes themselves, they, quote unquote, wasted more CO2, and that resulted in a sharp decline in those organisms, the blue dots, CUE, with temperature. And when we look at the isotope data, we see very similar patterns across these different carbon to nitrogen ratios of substrates that were offered. But when we look at the discrimination data, again, the green points are the values that you've already seen for a C to N of 10, but we saw no relationship, no monotonic function that was predictable across temperature for these different carbon to nitrogen ratios. We're not sure why this is. But I would argue that because we use stable isotopes as these indicators of ecological change, so this book is a great example of how we can do this, and we do things like look at the isotopic ratio of carbon in CO2 respired by ecosystems, and we develop healing plots, right, to try to find out what the isotopic signature of the substrate might have been that was generating that CO2. I think our data are suggesting that if that isotopic ratio is changing with temperature really dramatically when just one substrate is being offered, it should give us pause in trying to interpret these data from an ecosystem at an ecosystem level. So about 30-odd years ago, Graham Farquhar came up with his famous discrimination model, right? And that job, taking one substrate of CO2 and transforming it into photosynthate, because that process only used one substrate, this kind of model development was possible. So now we have the famous Farquhar model. And I think that we need to do some more studies looking at different microbial communities and different substrates, trying to understand the fundamental isotropic discrimination factor so that we can try to work towards something akin to this for soils. So as we start to work down deep, and programs like the Critical Zone Observatories allow us to really go deep and try to understand how microbes are functioning down closer to the bedrock, where the composition of the organic matter that they have available to them is very different from up at the surface. I think that this is a great opportunity for us to really explore some of these fundamental baseline data sets. And when we look at the amount of CO2 that is formed deep down in soils, trying to understand the source of that CO2 and its fate, I think that doing some of these fundamental microbial experiments are important. So that when we go out to the field and we measure carbon dioxide coming off the surface and carbon dioxide moving and diffusing within the soil profile down deep at deeper depths, and look at the isotopic composition of that, we can try to have maybe formulate a better understanding of the processes that generate it. And in that way, we can move across this nice figure that Henry Janssen made 10 years ago, where we're really looking at something very far on the left-hand side of the x-axis here, but really it's very relevant as we move out across the x-axis into the realms of soil organic matter. And I have some great thanks to give, especially to the people in my lab, and I can take any questions.
Did you continuously
It's a flow through system. So we're constantly adding. Yes.
So
both of them. It's a great. So the delta is the big delta, the discrimination, is not simply the difference, it's the discrimination factor, so it's actually a fraction. But so it's against the biomass, but you're bringing up a really important question that, in the interest of time, I didn't go into it. So where did the C13 go? So it had to have gone into microbial exudates, and so it had to have been in microbial products that were not in the biomass or in the CO2. So it had to have been in the exudates, but they didn't exudate and they didn't exude enough of it to modify the isotopic signature of the material that they were taking up in the medium. So we looked for that, and we couldn't find it. So we were looking for a very small change in a large pool, and it prohibited us from finding enough of an isotopic shift to find it. Yes, I think that the discrimination during that must have been meaningful, during that exudation process.
Thank you so much.